From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is Cool Science Radio.
Science and technology that's accessible and entertaining.
If we can understand it, you can understand it.
I'm Lynn Ware Peake.
And I'm John Wells.
Our guest is science journalist Lee Billings. He's a senior editor who covers space and physics for Scientific American. He joins us today to talk about how scientists have potentially discovered a new life-supporting planet. Now, if proven to exist, the planet might be 4 to 5 times larger than Earth. Lee will also update us on how the Mars rover Perseverance is doing following its thrilling landing on Mars last week. Lee Billings, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Hey, it's a delight to be here, and I'm a big fan of Park City, Utah. I haven't been out there in a couple of years, but what a gorgeous place. So very happy to talk to you today.
Well, we're happy to talk to you. And if you can just imagine in the mind's eye, we're sitting in the live studio, which looks up at the ski runs, and it's a bluebird day. We have lots of snow out there and more snow on the way this weekend. So how about that?
Making me jealous. I'm out here in Queens, New York. I'm looking at it's a concrete jungle here. Just lots of buildings, a little bit of snow, but yeah, no bluebird day or nice ski runs. Anyway. It could be worse. We could be on Mars, you know? So.
Well, yeah, that Perseverance there is doing a fine job on Mars right now. And we'll get to that in just a second.
Sure.
But well, there's a tie-in here. So for those of us who, out in the world, I think every time that there is something as exciting as the Mars rover, as Perseverance landing, everyone, like the whole world, tunes in for that moment or, you know, those couple of days surrounding some big event like this. And then they say, you know, I really ought to tune in more to what's going on in space because it is exciting. And yet they don't understand, you know, the difference between a star and a planet and what is Alpha Centauri and why might we be finding a new planet. So take us down to that observatory in Chile where the scientists, the astronomers, did see what we're talking about today. And what are they looking for? There's a great graphic in Scientific American about it, but help us understand.
Sure. Well, I just real quick I think you framed it really nicely there, Lynn, when you're talking about why, you know, kind of the bigger picture here. Why do we care about all this stuff and how can we kind of get excited about it? Why should we be excited about it? And the connection between something like a rover landing on Mars or finding what might be a planet in the habitable zone of a nearby star is that we're trying to discover our cosmic context. We're trying to figure out whether or not places like this and things like us, places being like Earth and things like us, people, are common or rare in the universe and how they come about. And, you know, kind of either prospect is mind-boggling. Either we're essentially alone and the whole universe is our playground and we're some kind of cosmic fluke. That's pretty mind-boggling. Or, you know, maybe life and planets that are like ours are common as dirt out there. And there's lots of cosmic company out there we could talk to and interact with someday, which is also mind-boggling. And going to Mars or looking for planets around nearby stars satisfies different aspects of that broader question. So in this case of people looking for a planet around Alpha Centauri is a double star system. There's two stars that circle each other. It's the nearest star system to our own. So other than the sun, if you're going to go out in space and look for some other place to live, Alpha Centauri is essentially your best bet. They were looking at this pair of stars, Alpha Centauri A and B. They're about, I think, 4.5 light years away, a little less than 4.5 light years away. And they were using an instrument on a very large telescope down in Chile, the 8.5 meter very large telescope. And they were trying to actually look at the star to see if they could see a planet around it. Now, that sounds really easy. Oh, well, you just, you know, a planet's big and stars are bright, but sure, planets are big. You should surely be able to see them around nearby stars, but we actually can't most of the time because stars are so very bright. And in the big scheme of things, planets are so very small. So this is kind of like looking for a firefly around the world's brightest searchlight when the firefly and the searchlight are in LA and you're in New York and you're trying to look for that firefly against that overwhelming glare of the spotlight. That's kind of what it's like to try to actually take a picture of a planet from across the light years nearby a star. So in this case, they were using this a specialized instrument to kind of filter out all the starlight on this big telescope while they were looking at Alpha Centauri A. Remember, there's two pairs of stars, Alpha Centauri A and B. And they seem to have found what could be a planet. But it's really hard to say, because what it really is it's a little tiny clump of pixels in a detector. And, you know, that clump of pixels is just where it looks to be a little brighter than the background. And I can get more into the details there if you'd like for your listeners. But the point is that there's a lot of things that can cause little clump of pixels in the detector. It could be something like a clump of dust that's around the star instead of an actual planet. It could just be a dust belt from rocks clashing together, kind of like an asteroid belt or something. Or it could even be just a little bit of light leaking around in their instrument and falling on the detector. So it could be something like that. And the reason why we don't actually know yet what it is because of COVID. Because, you know, you imagine you get a bunch of folks in the cold, dry mountain air of the Atacama in Chile in a tiny little control room all together to control a huge, big telescope. And that's not something that that most people really want to do. Right. So it's been troublesome. It's been hard to get astronomers down to the sites, to the telescopes, to do the work they need to follow up on this. And if the pandemic had not struck when it did, we probably would already be able to say whether or not this is a planet or whether it was just some kind of speck of dust or stray light in their instrument. So that's the basics of it. We probably will find out more about this candidate planet, if it's real or if it's not. I would guess later this year or next year, because everyone's really excited about it. You know, again, this is our nearest neighboring star. And look, we seem to have what might be a planet in the so-called habitable zone of this star. The habitable zone is where a planet can exist around a star, where it gets just enough starlight, just enough sunlight, so that it's not too hot and it's not too cold for liquid water to exist at its surface. Now, of course, liquid water is the foundation of life as we know it. So that's why we're following the water when we go out and look for places that life could exist outside of our solar system. It's also why we are following the water in other places, like on Mars, when we're sending robots there to look for life. So I could tell you a lot more if you'd like. I could talk for hours about the planet,
but
there's lots of other stuff. So just let me know where you want to go. We can go to Mars from here. I can give you more details about the planet candidate, wherever you want.
Lee, you have to come out of your shell. You're awfully shy.
I know. Good people tell me that all the time.
Well, let's go to this place. I'm kind of curious about. I would love to go to Northern Chile, up in the observatory. I'm sure you know you would like to go there even more than I would. And who knows? Maybe you have. And well, that's a good question. Like, how many people go to that observatory? Who can look through the Very Large Telescope? And is it just a matter of opinion? I mean, when you're talking about all these astronomers sort of gathering around saying, well, to me it looks like just a little bit of gas, or to me it looks like just a little bit of light, and to someone else it looks like a planet. Is that kind of how it's determined?
Well, okay, so a couple of different questions there, all very good ones. If you want to go to this site, it is pretty tough to get to. I managed to go there once myself while I was on assignment, and I had it was a long adventure, and it culminated in me driving at about 200 kilometers per hour through the desert to try to get there before nightfall. And I barely made it. It was pretty scary, though. It's desolate out there, you know, and you don't want to have your car break down in the middle of the desert. But if you want to go there yourself, I'll tell you what, there's actually kind of an easy way to do it, which is go watch one of the Daniel Craig James Bond movies. Which one is it? It's not the first one.
Oh,
it might be the second one. There's one where the bad guy has like his base actually at this site. Like the site looks so futuristic and has things like a buried underground swimming pool in it, in the driest place on Earth. Where the astronomers can go get vanilla ice cream and take a dip in between looking at the stars. So it's really fancy, but the film's producers went out and scouted it and saw it and were like, you know, this definitely looks like an evil genius's underground lair. So this is where we're going to have the shooting take place. So you can actually see a lot of that if you watch the movie. The way that it works, normally there's about anywhere between 5 to 12 folks who will go on these sorts of observing runs. And usually you do want to be there in person. Some of this stuff can be done remotely. So for instance, you know, here I am in Queens. In theory, I could operate that telescope remotely. all the way down in Chile and send it commands and figure out how to work it. But, you know, things go wrong, right? Machines are complex. So if something breaks or something isn't working correctly, you need someone on site to be able to address the issue. That's kind of why we can't do it all remotely. So normally you have people going on these observing runs from around the world, diving into Chile and staying there for some number of days to look at the stars. Now, the question of the debate over this planet, we actually do know a lot about what's not around these stars already from a variety of methods. So, you know, you'd figure since they are kind of our next door neighbors, just over the backyard fence, so to speak, you know, you tend to want to know your neighbors. You tend to want to at least know their names, maybe how many kids they have. What do they do for a living, right? Well, those kinds of questions. What's the deal with that pink flamingo in your yard, Dan? I don't know. Let's talk about it, right? It's that kind of stuff. So people have lavished these stars with attention for generations. And from that, we already know some other things about what's not there. We can know because these two stars orbit each other, Alpha Centauri A and B. That means that there's a lot of areas of what you'd call gravitational instability around them, where essentially a planet could not exist because if a planet was there, it would be thrown out of the system by one of the star's gravity. It would just be hurled into the depths of interstellar space, or it would be tossed into one of the stars to up. So we know that there's not planets within these so-called regions of gravitational instability. We also know from carefully watching the stars over periods of years and seeing how they kind of wobble back and forth. If you think about this, bear with me here for just a second for an analogy. You know how like when two figure skaters are like holding arms and then they're swinging each other around and then they're kind of like spinning around really fast on the ice?
Yeah.
I figure, you know, I'm using an ice metaphor because, you know, I'm thinking winter sports in Park City. Well, they have a common center of gravity in that case. And so actually they're kind of wobbling around, pulling each other back and forth. This is also kind of what happens with a planet and a star. A planet that's orbiting a star will gently tug on that star as it's orbiting it. And so you can actually measure, it's remarkable, we can actually measure via a technique called spectroscopy. We can measure these very, very minute tugs on the star and how the star wobbles back and forth. And so you can look at these wobbles, and if one comes around with a certain period, like, okay, look, it's a 365-day period, it's wobbling again, look at that. That could be evidence of a planet that you can't directly see, but you can still tell from that wobble. So we've been looking at the wobbles of these stars, Alpha Centauri B and A and B, for many, many years. And from those wobbles, we're able to say, okay, for instance, there's not like a something the size of Jupiter parked right next to one of these stars. We can already tell that. So what's nice about this candidate planet, and the reason why people are excited about it, is because it kind of fits within all the various constraints that already exist. You know, we can right. say, okay, we've looked for planets in some ways, and we know they're not there, but this candidate planet could fit in just kind of our blind spot where we haven't been able to see things for a while and we don't really know what's there. And it's plausible.
Right.
So there's lots of ways to check this, but ultimately what it's going to come down to is looking at the star again, using the same instrument. It's the only instrument on Earth that can actually do this measurement because it's able to filter out so much starlight to get that faint planetary light. And basically what they're going to be looking for is it going around the star? Is it moving around the star kind of like the hands on a clock, right? So if they can see the same dot, but
hey,
it appears in a different place, yeah?
I got to jump in there. We have a lot of questions for you. So,
oh, let's do it.
Okay, great. Lee Billings, he's senior editor who covers space and physics for Scientific American. We're talking about Alpha Centauri A and B, the pair of stars. There's also a small red dwarf called Proxima Centauri, and I wanted
That's
to
right.
ask you about that because there have been some recent reports that Centauri is emitting a strange radio emission, 982 megahertz, narrow beam, dubbed BLC-1. And I wanted to ask you, are we still observing this strange radio emission, and what do we think it is?
Yeah, okay, so BLC-1, I should say, I want to note really quickly that the the project that uncovered BLC-1, this potential emission from Proxima Centauri, as well as the project that uncovered this potential planet around Proxima Centauri's neighbor, Alpha Centauri A, they're part of the same umbrella institution or organization, which is called Breakthrough. So this Silicon Valley tycoon named Yuri Milner has devoted a portion of his fortune to looking for life in the universe, whether it's chatty aliens who are transmitting on the radio or looking for other Earth-like planets where maybe life could be found. He's bankrolling a lot of that stuff. So that's how we have these results. We have them from that organization building this special planet and upgrading equipment on the Parkes Radio Telescope in Australia, which is where this BLC-1 signal was detected. All because of that organization, I should say that.
And his approach is different than SETI's approach. SETI looks at a whole bunch of stars, and he sort of targets areas. Is that correct?
Well, there's a lot of different aspects of the project, which is called Breakthrough Listen, and they do some untargeted searching. They do also they have a lot of different projects they're working on with that money. In this case, it was a targeted search or a targeted monitoring of Proxima Centauri. And this strange signal did come up a couple of different times during an observing run. And what's so strange about it is the fact that it is so narrow. It's such a narrow band signal, and it didn't seem to It didn't fail any of the tests that folks normally do to determine that it came from a terrestrial source. So typically what happens is that people will look at the sky, they'll see some kind of signal come down, and it'll look artificial. And it'll look artificial because it is artificial. But it's artificial because we've sent a lot of artificial things into orbit and into space. We call them satellites and interplanetary spacecraft, right? So normally when you get this type of signal, it's from some overhead satellite, which means what you can do is if you kind of point the telescope away and point it back, and the signal should fade and come back. Or, you know, a lot of times if it's terrestrial or if it's from a satellite, it won't be quite so focused, and you will end up getting you'll point the telescope slightly away off axis, so to speak, and the signal will still be there because the satellite is still kind of hitting you with it. So in this case, it was a very narrow signal, just a very tight wavelength. So I mean, it's there's no known natural process out there that right now that could make this signal. But that said, right now the team is looking through the data, trying to figure out what could have caused it. And I have to say, the paper isn't out yet, so this is kind of, you know, hot off the press, not even off the press news. But it doesn't look like it's going to hold up. I'm pretty sure they are going to find out it is some form of terrestrial interference. And this is really complicated because these telescopes are so incredibly sensitive. Let me just give you a very quick anecdote. There was something for a while from this exact same telescope, this strange phenomenon they'd get where there would be these kind of flashes and spikes on radio wavelengths that it would pick up, and no one could figure out what it was. And people were thinking, oh my gosh, could this be, you know, some kind of profoundly exotic new astrophysical phenomenon that we've uncovered? Are we going to get Nobel Prizes for this and go to Sweden? And years later, after a lot of speculation, some researchers figured out that what actually had been causing those strange little spikes in radio or in microwave was someone microwaving their lunch in the break room right next to the dish. So that's how sensitive these things are. Those are the types of things that can happen here. I don't think that someone heating up a hot pocket is what caused this particular signal, but it does look, based on what I've heard from folks involved in the project, that it is not going to be aliens, probably not little green men. But stay tuned. We need to see the official peer-reviewed research first.
Yeah.
Hey, Lee, we have about 30 seconds before we have to start wrapping and go to NPR News. And
oh, no!
Oh, I know. And we just wanted to ask you if there's anything else that you wanted to tell us about this that we haven't talked about yet that you could tell us just briefly.
Well, I think the perseverance on Mars is very important. People should be paying attention to that because, you know, maybe it's going to find microfossils or something, in which case, hey, we're not alone. Really cool. So yeah. I think that's the story to watch right now.
Yeah, it's fascinating.
That's great. Our guest is Lee Billings. He is a senior editor who covers space and physics for Scientific American. He's also the author of a book, 5 Billion Years of Solitude, The Search for Life Among the Stars. And I love that play on the 100 years of solitude, since we've talked a lot about South America.
The Quantum of Solace.
Yeah. Oh, right.
Yes, that's the one. Check it out.
Is that the one where the bad guy drinks a quart of motor oil at the end when he's in the desert and he's dying of thirst?
Oh my gosh! I haven't actually seen it. I wouldn't be surprised.
Yeah,
I almost did that when I was on my way and I got stranded. No,
no kidding. We're all going to have to go back and watch that. I've actually been on a little bit of a tear recently of going way back to the late '60s and watching the James Bond.
Oh, yeah.
Movies.
Fantastic.
With Sean Connery. Love it. Well, Lee Billings, it's been a pleasure speaking with you. We'll have to have you back in a few months to talk more about what Percy is doing. Perseverance.
Ooh, yes. Yes. And don't forget Ingenuity the Helicopter. We'll talk soon. Thank you so much.
All right.
Thanks Lee.
Take care.
Yep. Bye.
Thanks for tuning in to Cool Science Radio.
If you enjoyed this episode, please rate us, give us a 5, and leave us a comment.
Take us along on your next adventure to the moon.
If you have any story ideas, please let us know at coolscienceradio@kpcw.org.
Thanks for listening. And hey, tune in next week.